You're listening to a 3CR podcast recorded in the 3CR Community Radio Studio in Melbourne, Australia. If you like what you hear, please consider donating or subscribing so we can keep bringing you more independent community content. For more information, go to 3cr.org.au.
3CR would like to acknowledge the Kulin Nation, true owners, caretakers and custodians of the land from which we broadcast. 3CR pays respect to elders past and present of the Kulin Nation. We recognise their unceded sovereignty.
This is 3CR Breakfast. Oh, yeah. Alternative news, analysis, and current affairs. Monday to Friday, 7 a.m. until 8:30 a.m. Only double. Clap your hands.
Good morning, listeners. You are tuned into Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM, and it is Thursday, the 19th of March. Good morning, Leela.
Good morning, Priya.
How's it going?
Yeah, pretty good. Just started the day off with some sinkhole discussions.
Exactly. And there'll be plenty more to come. If you haven't heard about the sinkhole, somewhere around Banyule Flats in Heidelberg, and yes, they won't let you see it. And I want to see it.
Yeah, I mean, who doesn't want to see a sinkhole? I think that that should be publicly available.
Yes,
to view.
Exactly. And as I was saying to Leela before, actually not very interesting to be very near a sinkhole that you can't see, because it really just doesn't look like anything.
Yeah, you want the thrill, you know, of seeing where the sink of the hole is.
Exactly. Also pretty ominous, and I look forward to speaking with Gurnung Jasper Cohen-Hunter about this morning, and he'll be our first interviewee. So Jasper is a Wurundjeri Woiwurrung Gulenj from NARM, and he's a media practitioner, writer, and community organizer dedicated to advancing the struggle for Wurundjeri sovereignty. And he's joining us this week to critically analyze past and present colonial assaults on the Birrarung, also known as the Yarra River, and to discuss the upcoming exhibition, Occupation Studies, which he collaborated on with artist Talia Palmer, and it's going to be showing at the Koori Heritage Trust from later this month.
And after that interview, we play part of an interview from 3CR's Dissociative Identity Disorder Awareness Day program with Amy Ciara and guest Jack discussing the intersections of DID and autism, problems with the NDIS, and what helpful therapy looks like. The whole program can be found on 3cr.org.au/DIDAD2026, and we'll have links for that in the show notes.
Awesome. And after that, we are going to be joined by Jay Coonan, Research and Policy at the Anti-Poverty Centre, who is going to be discussing the Anti-Poverty Centre's latest article, Welfare Not War, which was released earlier this month and urges the Albanese government to withdraw material support and diplomatic cover for the United States and Israel's imperial wars, and to instead prioritise investment in welfare, education, healthcare and other essential supports that benefit the public.
And then we hear from Dale Ruska, Goanpul Jandawal, Yugarabal Nunagul Gubbi Gubbi Gori, inherent member of the Aboriginal struggle and director of the Minjeriba Mugumpan Elders in Council. This morning, Dale will speak with us about a newly launched petition from Minjeriba Mugumpan Elders in Council calling for a national, independent, First Nations-led truth-telling and healing commission of inquiry to increase awareness about the historical truths of colonisation, intergenerational harms and ongoing impacts for First Nations people. The petition reiterates long-standing calls to formally recognise the overt racism that underpins the nation state of Australia, and follows two recent acts of racist violence, including the attack on Camp Sovereignty last year and the terror attack at this year's Invasion Day march in Boorloo, Perth. And if you need support with any of those themes, which are incredibly distressing, you can call Yarning Safe and Strong, which is a mob-only support line, on 1800 959 563, or you can also call Lifeline 24 hours a day on 131114.
And finally, we'll be joined by Shay from 3CR's Climate Action Show. We'll be listening to a segment where Shay from 3CR's Climate Action Show interviewed Tiani Adamson, who's the National Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Engagement Manager for Bush Heritage Australia. And in that segment, they talk about green colonialism, how it manifests in climate activism, and the overall nuances that come with considering solutions to confront climate change and better ourselves as activists. And you can listen to the Climate Action Show on 3CR on Mondays from 5 to 6 p.m. But for now, we will be back to you shortly with the news headlines.
In 2026, 3CR is celebrating 50 years on air. Help us celebrate 50 years. Subscribe.
Go to 3cr.org.au or call 03 9419 8377.
Don't have $1 million and still want to have a good education for your kid? Tune into the Dogs program. We are the defenders of government schools. 12 p.m. on Saturdays here on 3CR. 855 and AM dial podcast streaming live on 3cr.org.au and 3CR digital. We defend government schools because they need it.
You're listening to Thursday Morning Breakfast, and these are the news headlines for Thursday, the 19th of March. Severe tropical cyclone Narelle has intensified to a Category 3 system and is forecast to strengthen into a Category 4 or 5 cyclone before making landfall in far north Queensland tomorrow. Destructive wind gusts in up to 250 kilometres per hour, heavy rainfall and life-threatening flooding is predicted. Communities in the cyclone's path have been warned to prepare, with some islands and coastal areas evacuated as of yesterday. As of this morning, the Bureau of Meteorology has designated a warning zone from Lockhart River to Cape Tribulation and a watch zone from Koanyama to Weipa in far north Queensland.
Also in news, residents of the Nyoo Daily River in the Northern Territory say they have lost homes and belongings after record flooding submerged much of the community for the second time this year, forcing more than 350 people to spend weeks in evacuation centres in Darwin. First Nations Malak Malak people who were evacuated have experienced racism in Darwin and say they feel unsafe in the evacuation facilities, describing the distress of being evacuated twice in 2 months and the uncertainty of not knowing when they can return home.
In other news this week, Israel has launched a ground invasion of Lebanon, with strikes killing more than 800 people and displacement of over 1 million people, raising fears of a broader ground offensive. Israeli officials say displaced people will not be allowed to return until Israel has met its goals, and the Israeli defense minister openly compared the invasion to Israel's genocide in Gaza, threatening that the assault will mirror the destruction of Rafah. Other Israeli officials are threatening long-term occupation or annexation of southern Lebanon. While some global leaders have urged restraint from Israel, the Australian government has issued no statement opposing Israel's invasion of Lebanon. Israeli strikes killed senior figures in Iran this week, including Gholam Reza Soleimani and Ali Larijani. And in retaliation, Tehran launched missile attacks on Israel that caused casualties and widespread damage as the war continues to expand across the region. According to Iranian officials, at least 1,444 people have been killed in Iran and more than 18,000 injured in United States-Israeli strikes since late February this year.
Also in news, the High Court of Australia has ruled for a second time that forcing refugees and migrants living in the community to wear ankle bracelets and comply with curfews is unconstitutional. This latest ruling reaffirms a similar High Court ruling in 2024, which the Albanese government responded to by rushing through amendments to migration laws, attempting to give itself the power to reimpose the same restrictions. The latest ruling confirms that such restrictions amount to unlawful punishment and cannot be imposed. The ruling is expected to immediately affect more than 100 people, allowing them to live without monitoring or curfews and restoring greater freedom after years of restrictive conditions.
And finally, in headlines this week, a new Climate Council report has found that record fossil fuel pollution is overtaking natural climate patterns like La Niña and driving extreme heat, fires, and floods across Victoria this past summer. Despite typically cooler La Niña conditions, the state recorded unprecedented temperatures and more frequent disasters, with experts warning intensifying extremes are straining emergency services and will worsen without a rapid shift away from coal, oil, and gas. These have been the news headlines for Thursday, the 19th of March, and you're listening to 3CR on 855 AM.
Forests are essential ecosystems, mitigating for climate breakdown, cooling the planet, and preserving the wondrous diversity of life. Yet, they are being destroyed at an alarming rate. Here in the Kulin Nations, logging continues, increasing risk of both fires and floods. The Bob Brown Foundation is calling a national day of action, the March in March for Forests. In Naam, join us on Sunday, the 22nd of March at 11 a.m. in Parliament Gardens to demand the protection for native forests. Go to marchforforests.org for all the details, including how to volunteer. March for Forests, Sunday, the 22nd of March at 11 a.m.
A 3CR supporter.
Benvenuti, benvenuti al programma Radio Filet.
Mercoledì pomeriggio dalle 18:30 alle 19:30.
And for those who don't speak Italian, that's Wednesday evening, 6:30 to 7:30 p.m.
You'll hear from multi-generational Italian voices coming together to connect and learn and discuss Italian culture.
And politics.
And politics.
Radio File, building bridges between the diaspora.
The program will be part in Italian, part in English. So
practice your Italian or hone your listening skills.
Radio File, la voce alternativa della comunità italiana a Melbourne.
Tune in to 3CR, 855 AM, or you can listen online, 3cr.org.au.
Radio Filef.
Disasters like flood, fire, and extreme heat can have a significant impact on people's lives. Community legal centres help people experiencing challenges posed by climate change and disasters to access the resources and support they need. Disasters can lead to a range of problems, such as damage to your home, poor conditions with your rental home, difficulty getting insurance, issues within families, at work, and with Centrelink payments. Community legal centres can be found across Victoria and can provide help if you've been affected by a disaster. To find a community legal centre near you, visit the Federation of Community Legal Centres website at fclc.org.au. You can also contact Disaster Legal Help Victoria on 1800 113 432 and go to its website for helpful information at disasterlegalhelp.org.au. The Federation of Community Legal Centres is a 3CR supporter.
You're tuned in to Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. It is 7:13 in the morning, and we are now joined by Gurnung Jasper Cohen-Hunter, who is a Wurundjeri Woi Wurrungulinj from Naarm. He's a media practitioner, writer, and community organizer dedicated to advancing the struggle for Wurundjeri sovereignty. And Jasper joins us this week to critically analyse past and present colonial assaults on the Birrarung, also known as the Yarra River, and to discuss the upcoming exhibition, Occupation Studies, Nyanhura Bayaral Birrarung, They Tried to Tame Birrarung, which he collaborated on with artist Talia Palmer, who is of Yuwalare, Gamilaray and mixed European descent. Occupation Studies is showing at the Koori Heritage Trust in the Birrarung building at Fed Square from this Saturday, the 21st of March, until the 13th of September. Good morning, Jasper.
Good morning. How are you going?
I'm good, thanks. How are you?
Good.
So I wanted to start this conversation just by grounding us where we are. When was the last time that you visited the Birrarung, and can you tell us about that?
Oh, yesterday, but every day. I visit the Birrarung and its tributaries every single day, whether that's the Merri or the Darebin, and the connecting sites where the different creeks converge with the Birrarung.
Yeah. I mean, I've been spending the past couple of weeks visiting the Darebin Creek almost every day. And I think, you know, it, especially if you're thinking about the connections between the Darebin and Merri Creeks leading into the Birrarung, that site is incredibly significant. There's multiple significant sites around there. But for, you know, political sovereignty and community for Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people. So I was wondering if you could talk about that past and ongoing relationship between Wurundjeri and Woiwurrung political and cultural life and the Birrarung and those tributaries.
Yeah, of course. Rivers mark the clan territories of our people, and the convergences of different river systems mark where gathering places and important ceremonial sites are for our people. That's marked from all the way up from the Maribyrnong through Mini Ponds Creek, Gardiners Creek, Edgars Creek, Darebin, Merri. You can just go on and on and name these significant sites that flow into this river. The Birrarung is a significant site because it's the place where eels flow into the tributaries of the Birrarung during this season at the moment. And then you go further up north towards, you know, Baleen and Collingwood, where there's major eel hunting sites that serve as very significant gathering spots for people to commune together and eat.
You know, a lot of the work that is going to be surfacing in this exhibition, but also just a lot of the work that you've been doing in terms of, you know, public political communication about colonization here has focused on colonial incursions and the appropriation of the Birrarung. And what I've been thinking about as terraforming almost by colonizers in attempts to tame the river through things like widening, course diversion, dredging. Now, how do these colonial appetites for the use of the river as a resource sit alongside sovereign concerns about ongoing assaults on a living waterway?
Yeah, well, that's the thing about it being a living waterway, right, is that the Birrarung has essentially become a joke to, let's say, 50% of the people that live here, and they see it as the big, brown, dirty river. They don't see it as a living entity or what it once was. And you can go up as, you know, north to Healesville and Warrandyte, where the water's as clear as day, where it hasn't had these significant changes to it. But it's really quite simple. The river's been significantly manipulated for capitalism. And originally, when the river was widened and waterfalls were destroyed with dynamite, the original course of the Yarra used to flow through Footscray Road in the west, and there was significant swamplands there that had been filled in by sediment that had been taken out to create Victoria Harbour, or, you know, it was docklands. So much has changed simply to basically allow the boats to come in to quite a shallow water. When the Enterprise, the boat that the Port Phillip Association came through in, originally landed, they landed around the aquarium in Melbourne, what we know as Enterprise Park, because of how deep and shallow it was. How deep it was. And it was created by erosion and water that had been coming off these great basalt falls that had divided the salt and the fresh water from each other. And eventually, when that was destroyed and the major changes happened to the river, the sediment that had come up and the waste from not having a proper sewage system had essentially turned the river brown, undrinkable and poisoned. And this is what we know it as today. But there once was a fresh water river that was swimmable, that was drinkable. And people might not believe this, but it was the settlers and the colonials themselves that drank the fresh water when they first came here, because they didn't have a proper damming system until they created Yanyin and the Upper Yarra systems to drink from. So this water once was fresh, and it was all in their records too. We want to return to that. We want to return to a Yarra that's swimmable, that's drinkable, and sustains life, that isn't this poisoned mix of littering and, you know, it's memory from before.
Yeah, and it's this real tension, right, between the extractive imperative of, you know, wanting to make as much profit off these lands and waterways as possible, which always happens at the expense of the health and life of these places. And then, you know, the sovereign resistance that has always been there that is saying that, you know, this ecocidal impulse is not sustainable into the future. I wanted to ask about the extent to which, you know, regular planning and regulatory frameworks are able to mitigate against these harms in terms of actual, like, power sharing.
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, it's a real shame. I think the view of particularly water systems, but also land itself, grasslands we can't forget about, is always seen second when it comes to the so-called sort of long-term goals of urban development. And sometimes people in power can particularly see that land and water just sort of, like, the destruction of it becomes a consequence of things that they say will be better. And that could be for, you know, establishing new roads and highways, car parks, or tunnelling at the moment with the Northeast Link. And they sort of just brush it aside. And it's a real shame, actually, because I've only really been able to see a lot of loud resistance to these sort of things actually from, like, Liberal politicians, because they have an agenda against Labor. And it's only really now that we're starting to see a lot of these things that are happening really pick up and locals starting to get really pissed off about it. Mm. Yeah, it's a real shame.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, it's one thing for the Liberal Party to criticize the Victorian government about, you know, being in debt, and another thing to genuinely attend to the sovereign concerns about what is happening to these lands and waterways.
Exactly.
Yeah. I rode past the sinkhole in Heidelberg on the weekend, and I've been thinking about that and the bubbling of the Birrarung that's also been caused by the displacement of pressure by boring equipment that's tunneling underneath the river as part of the Northeast yep. Link. And I mean, these feel like pretty ominous signs to me, but what do you make of them?
Yeah, look, you know, people can easily just say, oh, well, it's not pressurized air, it's not pressurized gas, so it's going to be fine. You know, I posted a video about it, and I've seen every comment under the sun by citizen scientists that think they know everything. The real concern is, you know, what does this displacement have for things like the migration of eels and bird life that are temporarily there? You know, it's not just about the idea that the drilling might just instantly kill or destroy aquaculture, but it's actually, I'm thinking larger here, Brian. Can the disturbances potentially keep certain species away from the water for a particular amount of time that have migration patterns? What is the repercussions of that down the line? Animals and fish are constantly moving on Wurrung country. They're always migrating around. They're not particularly the type of animals that just stay put. And so when we have, like, severe changes to the environment, that can really mess things up. We just saw, for example, with the heat waves and the brimbank bat population, that they, like, were suffering from dehydration, and there was, like, a mass casualty event of bats in Brimbank Park, and that was due to one 40-degree day, and it's simply because the place that they're migrating to doesn't have, like, the right shade for them to be able to, you know, stay cool. So that's another example, right? So now we're thinking about the eels. What is this going to have for the repercussions of the eel population that come through the Birrarung?
Yeah, it is. I mean, to think about these mass casualty events, these changes in migratory patterns and the potential consequences of tunneling under the river to, you know, these broader ecosystems as merely incidental to, you know, development and progress is, you know, suggests that there's a massive shift in worldview that needs to happen to actually be sensitive to what matters in this place, what's always mattered in this place, and to understand that continuing to follow the profit motive and, you know, intensify development on already fragile places that have been subjected to rounds and rounds of, you know, reappropriation, reconfiguration, is just so inherently violent. And I know that you've been working with artist Talia Palmer on an upcoming exhibition, which, you know, does some retelling of the story of the Birrarung, counter-storying as well. Can you tell us about Occupation Studies, which is going to be showing at the Koori Heritage Trust?
Yeah, of course. So it's a multi-channel work, audio-visual, with a lot of old mapping and letters that actually show, like, the planning and schemes of destroying the river. It's contemplative, a counter-argument. We're actually using the evidence of what happened that the colonials wrote down against them. You know, these mappings show clear intent to destroy the river, displace communities. So it's a learning experience to come there and enter the space. It is a little confronting, but it will actually be this large space you can walk into to see very clear that the situation that we have right now of this very destroyed, brown and poisoned river, you know, wasn't always like this. There was a meticulous scheme that ended with the consequence of this over, say, 50 years, well, even today, right? Because even today there's still the destruction of the river. But we're looking at the historical manipulation and changes of it.
And, you know, just by way of wrapping up, is there anything that you wanted to add or anything you wanted to share with listeners about how you'd like them to enter that space?
Yeah, the best thing I would say is that, you know, if you come into Koori Heritage Trust and you feel annoyed about the historical changes to the river and what's occurred and what we have now, just remember that you can always resist today. And even though the widening of the river or the dynamite destruction of the Yarra Yarra Falls did occur historically, remember that things like tunnelling of the Northeast Link is currently happening, and you have the power within your own hands to resist that. And, you know, we can't ever get those basalt falls back, but we can disrupt the things that are currently occurring today. So I found all the videos about what was happening in Heidelberg on the Friends of Banyul Facebook page, but there's a lot of different local groups that are resisting against this sort of thing. So check out what's happening in your local area, whether it's the destruction of grasslands or it's mass casualty events of native wildlife due to heat waves. Get involved because, you know, we can look back in the past a few hundred years and get annoyed, but we can actually stop that from happening today. So, yeah, come into Koori Heritage Trust, get educated, get angry, and then get out there.
Thank you so much, Jasper. I really appreciate you making the time to talk with us this morning and, yeah, really encourage people to get to the Koori Heritage Trust and then do something with that knowledge. We'll speak to you soon.
No worries. Have a good day.
You too. And that was Gurnung Jasper Cohen-Hunter, who's a Wurundjeri Woiwurrung from NARM. And he joined us this week to critically analyze past and present colonial assaults on the Birrarung or Yarra River and to discuss the upcoming exhibition, Occupation Studies, Nyanhura Bayaral Birrarung, or They Tried to Tame Birrarung, which is a collaboration with artist Talia Palmer. And it's going to be showing at the Koori Heritage Trust in the Birrarung building at Federation Square from this Saturday, the 21st of March, until the 13th of September. You're listening to Thursday Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM, and it is 7:30 in the morning.
And I don't believe in fighting today in any one front, but on all fronts. In fact, I'm a black nationalist freedom fighter.
This country is a nation of thieves.
Now, we're never going to get justice here in these filthy racist courts here.
Our people have been massacred, and we're not supposed to grieve for that. We've got to do something more drastic if we're serious about this.
Move over or we gonna move on over you.
Yilliman with Kieran Stewart-Asherton on 3CR dives deep into Indigenous resistance and global anti-colonial struggles. Featuring frontline activists, it confronts Australia's identity, challenges power structures and fuels revolutionary discourse. Wednesdays, 12 to 1pm.
We play part of an interview now from 3CR's Dissociative Identity Disorder Awareness Day program with Amy, Ciara and guest Jack, discussing the intersections of DID and autism, problems with the NDIS and what helpful therapy looks like. Now, the whole program can be found on 3cr.org.au/DIDAD2026, and we'll have a link to the show notes as well.
Right from the start, she didn't really present us with like a model to understand DID. She didn't present us with specific terminology. I mean, obviously she had to use terminology to talk to us about it, but she kept it very loose. And so she wasn't like, oh yes, dissociative, you know, DID is a strategy that blah, blah, you know, like some of the explanations people have around why someone has DID. She was just like, hey, there's more than one of you. And so in the first year and a half or so of that process, she gave us the space to work out how we understand our experience and what terminology makes sense for us and how we make sense of the experiences that we have. Mm. And she follows our lead there. So we don't, like, for example, we talk about having different selves. I know other people might say they have different parts, or they might say they have alters, and all of those are valid. However someone talks about their thing is valid. Hmm. It's their reality. And so she made space for that, for our reality, and helped us to struggle through working out how to do that. You know, went through lots of different iterations of trying to make sense of all of this. And like similarly, because she didn't present us with this is the structural model of dissociation or whatever, we discovered for ourselves that we don't now and never have had a main self or a real self. And we have always been incredibly fluid in shifting, you know, mid-conversation often, mid-sentence sometimes. Yeah. And that is our normal. And it would have been, I can only imagine how damaging it would have been or how limiting it would have been if we'd happened to have a therapist who insisted on telling us what our condition was and how it worked and how we should understand it or make sense of it. Because then we'd have been trying to like mold ourselves into what we were supposed to be. Yes, in like response to the DSM's ridiculous arbitrary definitions. And because I've talked to people with DID who've said like their therapist refuses to talk to any of them except the one that she's decided is the real one. And like, how harmful is that?
Yeah.
You know, it's like, so yeah, I think for us space is in therapy is mostly around not just allowing, but supporting us to find our own way, both to understand ourselves and to work through our trauma and our struggles with DID.
And does your therapist, mine is quite careful about how she pokes and prods around in our mind. You know, she, it's her job to ask certain questions and to explore certain things, but our mind is a minefield when it comes to traumatic memory and feelings of the different, I call them my headmates. So how does your therapy look when it comes to poking and prodding around? Do you have systems of communication? Like how do you go about it? How does your therapist go about it with you, I should say?
Yeah, I would say that she has always had us almost entirely in the lead. Like she rarely will say, hey, I think we need to come back to this, or I think we need to talk about this. In fact, almost never. So she just works with whoever turns up on the day. We do make agreements. Like at the moment, one of the younger ones is kind of consistently working with our therapist twice a week on specific on processing a specific trauma event. And then we have a third day. We've just started having three sessions a week instead of two, which I know is an incredible luxury. And so that third session as of last week is going to allow the rest of us to kind of check in and maintain a relationship with our therapist, because although we're really grateful for the trauma processing that's being done, we were finding that the rest of us were feeling a bit abandoned and disconnected from our therapist because we weren't talking to her for extended periods of time.
We've been really privileged as well to have a therapist who, whatever we can afford, has tried to see us every week. And we moved from Sydney to Melbourne years ago, and she just continued to see us via telehealth. And while that has some limitations, it's been so important for our stability, our health and well-being to keep seeing her. And sorry, mind slipping for a moment.
You're good. I get it.
You touched on something there, which is we are people who have suffered some significant trauma. We need consistent therapy. Could you tell me a little bit about you know, why it's important that you get like consistent therapy? Because one of the points I've raised in this broadcast is that there's no Medicare recognition for there really is nothing in the Medicare allowance to specifically say people with complex trauma or dissociative disorders should get more Medicare, even though there are mental health conditions that do get you extra sessions. And it's something that I think could be a really good starting point for people living with complex trauma and dissociative disorders in getting. So yeah, tell me a little bit about why it's important that you get that consistent, regular contact with a therapist.
Sure, yeah.
You and your crew, I should say, because they would all have their different reasons and needs, right? So same with our system, yeah.
Exactly, yeah. So I guess I have two thoughts about that, both of which immediately disappeared. one is, so I guess the first one touches on what I was just saying. I think a lot of people with complex trauma and dissociative disorders have fairly significant attachment trauma fairly often. And so a large part of the therapeutic process is around relearning safe attachment and relearning that you can safely disagree with someone or safely tell somebody that they said or did something that upset you and experience that, you know, like the rupture repair dynamic in a therapeutic relationship. And that takes a lot of time. It's not something you can fix in 10 CBT sessions. It's an ongoing process that takes years. to establish safety in relationship. And you need somebody with very good training and skills to do that. And so that needs stability and ongoing care. And then on top of that, you know, there are very, very many of us that live in this body mind, and many of us have our own traumas that are specific to us. And at the moment, you know, like, we just have to pick somewhere and start. And so, you know, we had decades of being diagnosed with treatment-resistant PTSD. What was actually happening was that although we were getting therapy, the one of us who held that trauma wasn't getting the therapy. So we weren't getting better. So now we need enough sessions. We need enough therapy to trust that all of us will get a chance to work on the things that we carry that are so traumatic and painful. And yeah, Medicare does not reflect that, you know, and the NDIS doesn't do anything to.
You're tuned into Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM, and that was part of an interview with Amy Cara and Jack from 3CR's Dissociative Identity Disorder Awareness Day, originally broadcast earlier this month on the 5th of March. And you can listen to the whole conversation, including other interviews with folks specifically focused on dissociative identity disorder awareness, by heading to 3cr.org.au/DIDAD2026. We'll have a link to that in our show notes. And you can also hear Amy on Kill Your Lawn, Kick Your Fence, which is broadcast on Fridays at 9 a.m. right here on 3CR 855 a.m. It is 7:42 in the morning, and I might do a little weather check. So we had the cyclone warning before. That's just far north Queensland, thankfully not here. Today we are looking at a high of 21 degrees. It's going to be cloudy, a slight chance of a shower, and hopefully a little bit of sun peeking through towards the end of the day. Right now it is hovering at around 18 degrees.
The state Labor government has begun works on demolishing Melbourne's 44 public housing towers to be replaced with private housing. Already hundreds of residents have been displaced, often into unsuitable homes under duress.
The towers on Racecourse Road, Flemington, have become Homes Victoria work sites, while the families still living in the buildings are being treated appallingly.
Join Save Public Housing supporters in solidarity with residents.
Weekdays 7:30 till 9 a.m. as we engage with passing traffic to make some noise and show Jacinta Allen
that the demolition of public housing is unacceptable. Signs and banners provided, or bring your own.
There's power in numbers, so see you at 120 Racecourse Road, Flemington, 7:30 till 9 a.m.
Save Public Housing is a 3CR supporter.
Welcome back to 3CR Thursday Breakfast. And now we are joined by Jane Coonan, who is the Research and Policy Head at the Anti-Poverty Centre, joining us to discuss the latest article, Welfare Not War, released on the 10th of March, urging the Albanese government to withdraw material support and diplomatic cover for the US and Israel's imperial wars and prioritise investment in welfare. Good morning, Jay.
Good morning.
Thanks so much for joining us here today. I was really interested in your article from the Anti-Poverty Centre because it really speaks to the everyday impact that is felt by our government's like excessive defence spending. I'm wondering if you could, yeah, just talk us through what is happening with defence spending right now. And, you know, we're seeing so many social programs being cut. If you could lay the landscape for us.
Yeah, for sure. So I think the key thing here is that it is despicable for the Prime Minister, who has a history of anti-war activism, especially during Iraq, and apparently in the past being opposed to the genocide of Palestine, is now supporting the invasion of Iran. He was the first off the blocks in support of it, which just goes to show that, you know, there is just no goodwill coming from this government in its, you know, the stage that it's in. And just to make matters worse, it is, you know, supporting the death and destruction of innocent lives. And at the same time, it is investing hundreds of billions of dollars into the AUKUS war machine, supplying arms and fuel into this global conflict and purchasing more missiles, which has been indicated will be part of the upcoming budget in May, which only goes to, again, fuel the war machine and the stock prices of Raytheon and all large weapons manufacturers, while at the same time they're making cuts to the NDIS here, where, you know, there is a concerted effort by the media to attack and undermine the social legitimacy of a program that contributes not only to the economy, but provides so much wealth to individual lives and families. And yeah, I think it's just goes to show that, you know, this is the true heart of this Labor government, is not to care for the lives that are being lost in conflict zones, but it's also actively undermining the lives of disabled people, First Nations people, and poor people across this continent.
Yeah, thank you so much for outlining that. And I think it's so felt through how horrific it is to see that this is happening, but also how complicit Australia is and has been forever. But particularly now with, yeah, Albanese being the first person to say, yeah, this is fine. We're having, you know, Pine Gap being used as a military force. And I wanted to talk a little bit more about how it's affecting, like, social programs here, because so often you hear, like, oh, we just don't have money to do that, or we just don't have money to do this. But then you're seeing, like, you know, with the budgets coming up, that you have the, like, the next government defense budget update coming, and you're seeing that you're getting, like, billions and billions of dollars being sent to, quote unquote, protect our borders or whatever. But here, we have stagnating wages. We have the RBA, you know, mortgage, interest rate rise, predatory supermarket pricing, and lagging wages. I guess, how do you think that we're able to kind of justify this in our minds that we, yeah, we don't, that it just, like, keeps coming up and is completely decimated?
Yeah, I think there has just been a concerted long-term effort by, you know, both Labor and Liberal government to justify, you know, the way that budgets are structured, and that there is only very limited amounts that go to social spending, but also that the majority of the, you know, the tax spending goes to, like, middle classes. So it's just been very, like, normalized that, you know, social programs or programs for communities are just nothing that we actually, you know, spend our budgets on. So, you know, I think that is probably something that's going to change when, you know, there's been this hyper-normalization that you have to just, like, duke it out amongst other people in your community for survival. But, you know, as the RBA, you know, increases its interest rates, and more people are going to be suffering, whether that's through higher rents or higher mortgage costs. We're also seeing petrol prices. So, you know, the craze of buying these massive Yank tanks and Raptors that cost hundreds of thousands of dollars that are now going to cost, you know, near on $400 to $500 to fill up. Like, it's going to cause a lot of shocks through, you know, our society and our economy. And, you know, this government is just not really well equipped to, you know, handle that at all. Like, you know, what should be coming out of this is a recognition that, you know, the supermarkets are price gouging. You've got energy companies who are price gouging, leading to some of the highest bills ever. And the banks are making super profits from RBA decisions. Like, you know, we already have the money to, you know, provide more than enough in society that we need, whether that's higher welfare payments or funding the NDIS. But now we've got this opportunity where we can do all that, well, plus more, because they can just take all this wealth that is just being hoarded or sent overseas or put into investment funds and invest it directly into the community.
Yeah, it's so clear that the money is obviously there. And I was looking at the upcoming like reports of the defence budget that will be, released soon, that it's probably likely that we will increase our defence funding, which is like 2% of our entire GDP, and then compare that to healthcare, which is 10% of our entire GDP, which more than 2% is already like going beyond our margins. When we're looking at like why Australia is like such a player in this market, I mean, financially, globally, what pool does kind of Australia have? Or do you feel like it's like increasing currently with like AUKUS and being a supporter?
Yeah, I think like Australia is no different to the trends in increased defence spending, in inverted commas.
Yeah.
Like Europe has been going down this path for a number of years now. In Europe, they've been arming themselves to the teeth generally because of a few things. It's obviously the invasion of in Ukraine, and then there's also the fact that America is becoming less reliable within a NATO partnership and has also been encouraging them to increase their defence spending. So naturally, Australia, being the, you know, the rednecks of Asia that we are, have also followed suit in increasing their so-called defence expenditure, because that is the way that global markets in the West are going, is arming themselves to the teeth. So we're not really unique in that. So it's just as terrifying that we just kind of take our lead from, you know, tens of thousands of kilometres away, deprive our society and don't actually, you know, contribute to a de-escalation effort. And instead we take, you know, our marching orders from Donald Trump, who is telling us to increase our defence spending. And you have the Deputy Prime Minister, Richard Marles, who cares more about being American than he does care about, you know, increasing the living standard of, you know, people on the continent here.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much. And maybe it's just by some of my older circles where sometimes you can talk about like, yeah, improving welfare conditions or increased tax breaks, and people who maybe are, yeah, still struggling, yeah, can like feel the grocery hikes and the rent hikes. But when it comes to like maybe taxing richer people, sometimes, I don't know, how do I say this, but sometimes when people can feel like their personal like $1 million or $1 billion is not that far away from them, so they sometimes are like thinking about their imaginary future millionaire self that's going to be taxed. But I think often people don't really know how much $1 billion is. I know it's a bit of a side tangent, but yeah, it's like, what does it actually mean to have like that much billionaire wealth when it comes to like taxing the rich? Because so often it's like, oh, they're going to tax everybody the kind of same portion. You know what I mean?
Yeah, look, I think the concept of $1 billion is just so strange in itself. Like, you know, no one's going to be a billionaire. Well, very few people will be a billionaire. But again, like most of that wealth is tied up in like physical assets. And the way that, you know, these billionaires and multimillionaires are able to accrue this amount of wealth is by just slowly accumulating more and more assets. And that in Australia is generally in property. So, you know, what we're finding is that these multimillionaires and billionaires, while they might have side businesses, their other thing is investing in property. And, you know, what that is doing is extracting the wealth out of people who, you know, work minimum wage jobs, or even people who work in professional class jobs, are paying rent into, you know, the passive accounts of these, you know, billionaires, and other parts of their wealth is in share prices. So we see companies like supermarkets, banks, and energy companies like pushing for profits and profits and profits at the expense of ordinary working class people, in order to make higher dividend prices for their shareholders. So it's not so much that we need to take the money away from these billionaires and multimillionaires. So we need to stop incentivizing a massive profit drive in an economy, because it's just leading to people becoming working poor and more precarious in their day-to-day lives, and it contributes absolutely nothing to the day-to-day lives of, you know, ordinary people.
Yeah, thank you so much. Yeah, it is such a precarious way to financially live, and knowing that it's publicly opposing war and like demanding economic justice at home is so important. Just to wrap up, Jay, would you want to say how we can like move towards more societal organizations that claim to represent community interests, you know, from trade unions, think tanks, welfare organizations to climate movements to really oppose military expenditure?
Yeah, I think it's important to join your union, and to, if you're a part of any civil society organisation or political party, if that's your flavour, then agitate. We all need to agitate together for an anti-war stance and to, you know, fight for economic justice, because, you know, it's integral that, you know, the fight starts at home, because people dying overseas affects us here. So, you know, everyone is doing it. Keep up a good fight, or if you're curious, you know, get in touch with us or any other anti-war movement. Find out how you can help.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Jay, and have a great day.
You too. Thanks so much.
Thanks. And that was Jay Kuhn, Research and Policy Head at the Anti-Poverty Centre, who joined me to discuss the latest article, Welfare, Not War, released on the 10th of March, and we'll have that linked in our show notes as well, about how our government is providing so much material support and diplomatic coverage for US and Israel's imperial wars instead of investment in welfare, healthcare, education, and so much more that benefits the public.
Women on the Line, a radical intersectional current affairs program.
Making space for the voices of women and gender diverse people.
Featuring in-depth conversations with guests from so-called Australia and beyond.
Ultimately, we're looking to care for country, to continue our culture, to continue our ceremonies, so that our children have a strong sense of self and belonging.
Just because our marginalization intersect where we're both disabled, it doesn't change your white privilege. It doesn't change your straight privilege. It doesn't change your able-bodied privilege.
Sex work, the word itself, has been such a word with a lot of stigma. However, we cannot ignore that there are women out there who are making their livelihood out of this job.
Listen every Monday morning at 8:30 on 3CR Community Radio, 855 AM, or stream live on 3cr.org.au.
Love podcasts? We've got you. Find Women on the Line via the Community Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Women on the Line, where about?
Feminisms in their multitudes.
First Nations sovereignty.
Land back.
Trans liberation. Poo-poo on the turfs.
Abolition.
Anti-racism.
Sex worker rights.
South liberation.
Disability justice.
Anti-imperialism.
Decolonisation.
An end to borders.
Workers' justice.
And so much more.
Women on the Line, broadcasting on the 3CR airwaves since 1986.
Woo! Woo!
You're listening to Thursday Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. And just a warning for all our listeners, and particularly our First Nations listeners out there, the next conversation will touch on racism and systemic harms against First Nations people. If you're a First Nations listener who needs support, you can call 13YARN on 139276 or Yarning Safe and Strong on 1800 959 563. Now, I am so appreciative to announce our next guest, Dale Ruska, Gawonpul, Jandawal, Yugarabul, Noongar, Gubbi Gubbi Gori, inherent member of the Aboriginal struggle, and Director of the Minjeriba Mugumpan Elders in Council. In our next conversation, Dale is going to tell us about a newly launched petition from Minjeriba Mugumpan Elders in Council, calling for a national, independent, First Nations-led, truth-telling and hearing commission of inquiry to increase awareness about the historical truths of colonisation, intergenerational harms and ongoing impacts for First Nations people. The petition reiterates long-standing calls to formally recognise the overt racism that underpins the nation state of Australia and follows two recent acts of racist violence, including the attack on Camp Sovereignty last year and the terror attack at this year's Invasion Day march in Boorloo, Perth. Good morning, Dale.
Good morning, Leila. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. Yeah, I'm really looking forward to our conversation and what a privilege to have you on the show.
Oh, and that's great. And I thank you so much for giving me the opportunity. And yeah, good morning to all of the listeners out there.
Now, Dale, you are an elder yourself. You're the director of Minjeriba Mugumpan Elders in Council. I thought we could start by learning about you through an introduction of your ancestors and your elders. And could you share some ways that they guided you to this work that you do now?
Yes, I could. Thank you. Yes, I'm, as you say, Gurumpal Jandrabal, Yagrabal and Nunugal Gubbi Cubby, Guri. I come from three families on the island here in Moreton Bay, southeast Queensland. The Moreton family, the Ruska family and the Newfong family. All three of my families have been very active and prominent in the Aboriginal struggle for the last six or seven generations or so, starting from the very first frontier wars fought here in Queensland. And I just, as an Aboriginal man being born into that struggle, are just carrying on from the ancestors before me. And in recent times, the last 4 to 5 years, I've become a member of the Minjeriba Mugumpan Elders in Council. But I've spent the last just under 40 years being a part of our community-led self-determined efforts, starting from back in the early 90s when the elders appointed me to coordinate our claim and appointed me then as the applicant to lodge that claim. And that was all pre-native title sovereign effort initiatives and objectives. And unfortunately, the government responded by introducing the Native Title Act as a mechanism to counter the First Nations-led efforts in Queensland here. And that included, prior to our claim, Kondamooka being lodged, the efforts of Mabo and the Wikwani. So, yeah, I feel very proud to be a part of our struggle, and I believe in our First Nations' importance as the rightful original owners of this country. And I know that in this country, prior to colonial invasion and trespass, there was at least 800 of our tribes that belonged to at least 300 different language nations groups. And we had that sole ownership and occupation for no less than 65,000 years, as evidenced by Western archaeological assessments.
Yeah, thanks so much, Dale. Now, you talked a little bit about that pre-native title environment of like fighting for sovereign rights. And I think it ties in with my next question about how these laws of this colony are actually designed to conceal and allow harm against First Nations people. I think native title is one example of that, and the ways that the colony can kind of use their own laws to continue the oppression of First Nations people. Linking this to the petition and the commission that you're calling for, can you talk me through the importance of First Nations designed and led truth-telling as a starting point for justice and sovereignty, I guess, within these colonial laws that we've been given, unfortunately? But, yeah, could you talk me through the importance of that?
Yeah, well, truth-telling is something that's not new. And for us as First Nations people who didn't rely on recording our history in a written form, truth was essential because it allowed for our ancestors to be able to inform themselves and share how they were informed with other tribes, but it also allowed them to establish culture and to establish law. Mm. And through truth, they were able to transition culture and law across many millenniums. And for us as First Nations people, truth is something that is a part of our ancient being. And truth also is what's necessary to inform human morality. And without truth, we exist in a state of immorality and fiction. And for our efforts here in Queensland, our people's voices and their truths were expressed from the first landings of the first colonial invaders. And for us, it involved the members of the different British military regiments. And that those troops were cried in the first war cries in defence and resistance to that invasion, and they've been expressed in many, many letters and submissions, and the voices have been crying as loud as they could in many hundreds of protests across the nation.
And
it's just a bit unfortunate that due to the way the colonial empire believes that there's this assumption that whiteness is superior, the black being inferior, and that's all motivated from racism, that they have privilege entitlement. And when we think about that and we think seriously about that, and our time of being across at least 65,000 years involves at least 4,500 generations of our ancestors transitioning knowledges from truths. And when we look at the colonial time of illegal occupation, it only involves around 12 to 15 generations, so there's no comparison whatsoever.
Yeah, absolutely. It's such a small portion of time, like colonisation versus the millennia that First Nations people have been building law and culture and, histories here.
Now, that's right. And if I could just say, and if we look at every single law that's been developed to administer over us, from the first laws up until the most recent, every single one of those laws has been in draconian type laws that have designed to administer and suppress Aboriginal people. And even with native title, and when our people face native title up here, it caused a lot of conflict and division for us. And I acknowledge also, in those early days of the 90s, I acknowledge Monica Morgan and Robbie Thorpe, because we had a lot of collaborative engagement with them. And I also expressed my disappointment in the government for allowing and recognising that the Yorta Yorta rights and claim efforts were all extinguished as a result of the waves of colonialism. But a lot of our people weren't fully informed up here. And so the majority agreed to the consent determination, but some, and my Morton family and myself, as the applicant, opposed it outright and objected to native title. And we made it quite known publicly that instead we chose to reserve fully our First Nation sovereignty as original first owners of place. And recently, as a result of native title, and this is a call out to the country, one of our men from the island here believed that native title gave him the right to go out and clear a parcel of land to build the homes for his family on. And he chose to clear it adjacent to a really extremely high market property value urban site known as Point Lookout. And due to the response of the public, he was then prosecuted for committing the indictable offences of land clearing. And he's been to and fro from the courts at least three times. And the most recent time, the courts found that it was his honest belief of right.
Yeah.
And the local government's now appealed to the High Court, and the High Court's accepted leave for appeal to try to prosecute him further. But there's literally hundreds of people on Stradbroke Island who held that same opinion as their honest belief of right, that have gone out, cleared land and built their homes on country, that are all going to be now liable for prosecution.
Wow.
And that comes as a result of native title not being properly informing the First Nations people, and it's about native title also being racist. and coercing Aboriginal people into accepting discriminatory Indigenous land use agreements. But when we talk about justice, justice has always been a part of our historical efforts and our fight within the Aboriginal struggle. But it's not a new thing with regards to our sovereignty, because our sovereignty is ancient and it's never ever been ceded by our ancestors nor ourselves.
Yeah, thank you, Dale. You provided such an important example of how coercive it is to try and fit the rights of First Nations people into a colonial law system and then use it against them and just repeat those same patterns. And this commission that the petition is calling for really wants to me, it seems like, try and start breaking out of that really violent pattern. And something that I was thinking about when I was reading the words of the petition was how First Nations leaders have always used creative strategies to speak truth back to these colonial systems, to speak truth on their own terms, honouring culture and ancestors and land. And an example I kind of was thinking about as well was the Yurok Commission held hearings on country. So in this commission that you're proposing with the Minjeribah Mugumpan elders, what could truth-telling look like? Who could contribute and how might those hearings take place?
Yeah, well, truth-telling wouldn't vary too much to how it's always been for us as a people and how we've always tried to communicate our sovereign opinions to non-Indigenous society of Australia. And we just need to look at the example of the 26th of January every single year, where our people gather in mass at every capital city across the country to voice our opposition to the celebration of Australia Day and our titling that day as the Day of Invasion. And that's an important assertion of sovereignty.
Yeah.
And nothing can stop those sorts of assertions happening. And even here in Queensland, like, we've seen some really harsh, draconian laws introduced after the recent state of elections. A first one being the immediate commitment and immediate first action of Parliament to repeal the Pathways to Treaty and the Truth-Telling and Healing Commissioner's Bill. And the second one being the introduction of adult time for adult crime, which has resulted in the youth detention and adult detention centres being overwhelmingly full by First Nations people. And this is as a result of lacking understanding around the importance of truth.
Yeah.
And those laws were introduced by a premier who in his electoral campaign proudly promoted that he was the first generation Australian and that his parents immigrated to this country just prior. And if we look at that attitude that's held by the majority of Australians, and if we look at what happened last year with the March for Truth efforts that were led by a lot of neo-Nazi principled people, Australia is lacking in understanding of their own historical truth, and they claim pride when they celebrate every Australia Day, and that pride's claimed on this lacking understanding and not knowing truth. And when we look at that importance of truth and how it can be done, the Yurok community formed the commission and the Queensland community also formed the commission. And that would be a similar model for us to use at a national level, where it would rely on First Nations people immediately to use self-determination to initiate. And that would involve us all coming together through networking and identifying and being committed to the needs of the importance through cultural agreement and commitment. And for us as First Nations people, then we could then lobby to form our own First Nations representative body in each state, maybe nominating a couple of commissioners to be on the National Commission. And we'd just hope and encourage federal government to then get behind us and support us by prioritising legislation and introducing it to also include the allocation of significant resourcing and funding to allow it to happen. And then each state could collaborate together through their commissioners to form a national commission. And that would also be something that we could allow to be open to high-profiled potential non-Indigenous representatives, but also we could try to encourage each of the human rights commissioners from each state and from at the federal level to be a part of that. And the first thing I'd see as being necessary, and I've had some of these discussions already with Travis Lovett, from the Wolf for Truth in Victoria, is we could start to formulate and draft our own terms of reference and objectives for truth-telling. And from that, we could then work out how the process could progress. And it would need to ensure, for the sake of its independence, that it's a totally First Nations-led initiative. And that's something that we're quite capable of doing. It's something that we do all the time within our communities. Yes, that's right.
Dale, thank you so much for your time and the words you've shared and ideas. And, we've got models to go on to have this commission. It's long overdue. I just want to reiterate that. And
too long overdue.
Yeah. And, Dale, thank you so much. I could talk to you all day, but we have to wrap it up there for this morning. I hope you have a beautiful day up there in Queensland. And yes, look forward to talking next time.
And that's for sure. And if I could just take a quick second.
Yeah,
to all of the listeners out there, all of our mob, we're supposed to be just over 3.5% of the national constituency, but that's well over 500,000 of us. Please all get behind this effort and step up and stand beside us and so that we can walk together. And sign our petition at truthtellingcommission.good.do. And also get behind the Yurok community and the Walk for Truth that's planned to occur between the 19th of April to the 27th of May, because we plan to send a delegation down from up here in Queensland to support that walk as well.
Yeah,
so
thank you
very much, Leila.
We'll include all those details in our show notes. Goodbye for now, Dale.
Goodbye and take care.
You too. You just heard the voice of Dale Rusker, inherent member of the Aboriginal Struggle and director of the Minjeriba Mugumpan Elders Council, who are calling for a national independent First Nations-led truth-telling and hearing commission of inquiry to increase awareness about the intergenerational harms and ongoing impacts of colonisation for First Nations people. It is 8:18 in the morning and you are listening to 3CR on 855 AM.
And we're now going to go to our final segment for today, which is a clip from 3CR's Climate Action Show, where host Shay interviewed Tiani Adamson, the National Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Engagement Manager for Bush Heritage Australia. And in this conversation, Tiani talks about green colonialism and how we see it in climate activism, as well as the nuances that come with considering solutions to confront climate change and better ourselves as activists. And you can listen to the Climate Action Show on 3CR on Mondays from 5 to 6 p.m.
Tell me a little bit about Bush Heritage Australia and what your role is.
So Bush Heritage Australia is one of the largest Australian conservation organisations, and we're really lucky to be able to care for and protect over 20 million hectares of land alongside our partners with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities, as well as agricultural partners as well. We own 10 million hectares of that land, half of it, and take it under our stewardship and custodianship to partner with traditional custodians as well and restore landscapes back to their health. So it's a really cool place. It was founded by Bob Brown about 30 years ago, and our mission is healthy country protected forever. So when we take land into our title, there's no risk of it being mined or deforested or destructed anymore. It's all about reinvigorating health back into the landscape, bringing people back out onto country, having that generational knowledge transfer with communities and people, learning and living on the land and understanding the landscape and protecting native species. So we protect over 7,000 native fauna across our reserves at the moment, which is pretty incredible, especially in a biodiversity and climate crisis. And I feel really lucky to be able to work in this space. I think there's a lot of issues in the conservation sector in terms of greenwashing or pretending like we're doing a lot better than what we really are, and black cladding as well, of, you know, making it sound like partnerships or work with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people is being done really well, when in actual fact it's not on the ground. And I feel incredibly lucky to be working for a conservation organisation that does things in the right way, that actually cares for, protects and partners and has amazing impact with boots on ground. So it's one thing that our supporters and our donors really love about Bush Heritage is we get things done on country, and they can see the impact and they can see the health of country improve through photos, data, visits and narrative storytelling through our communities as well, which is pretty incredible.
And as a conservation organisation that exists in a country with such a strong colonial history, how does Bush Heritage Australia go about aligning with Indigenous peoples in a way that doesn't reinstate colonialism, or in a way that, as you said, doesn't kind of seem very surface level and for show? What do you do differently in that way?
Yeah, we use this practice called Right Way approach and Right Way science. And Right Way is a familiar term across many Indigenous communities globally, and it's applied across a lot of different situations. And Right Way doesn't infer that there's a wrong way, but it means doing what is the right approach for all engagement. So there's a really strong problem that can happen when we talk about the incredible knowledge system of Indigenous knowledges, which has meant in the past, since colonisation here in Australia, that a lot of people have seen Indigenous knowledge as a commodity and something that can be extracted and profited from. And that's highly problematic when we're trying to reconcile and repatriate country and repatriate culture and revitalise our language systems. So Right Way means that we work with communities in the right way. We're not taking knowledge. We're not profiting from Indigenous law and language. We're working with communities on the ground. We're determining ways that we can work effectively. It's built on foundations of trust and respect. We make sure that we answer questions around ICIP, which is Indigenous Cultural Intellectual Property. We always make sure that we work under the rights of Indigenous people under the UN, which is things like FPIC, so free, prior and informed consent, where Indigenous people have a right. So I'm an Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander woman on both sides of my family, and it's our right as Indigenous people to know when work is happening on our country, and that is obligation of companies like Bush Heritage to check in with communities about that. We need to make sure that we have an appropriate mix of methods and knowledge systems coming together, and that there's a reciprocity. My brain this morning, I'm so sorry, reciprocity in these knowledge systems sharing across. So, yeah, I think Bush Heritage does a good job of, we're really strong, we've been really grounded in Western science across Australia, you know, since it was colonised. There's been a huge preference, globally really, when any place is colonised, that there's been this absolute demoralisation, extraction from Indigenous knowledges, and our entire preference and looking at Western language and models and knowing of being and weighing and being, knowing and doing as the most utmost high form of knowledge, which is absolutely wild when you think about equity and diversity and the value of diverse knowledge systems. And so, you know, I know as an Indigenous woman, and Bush Heritage knows as a place that partners with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities, that there is no one foremost, most incredible knowledge system that we need to value. What we require to have better systems and a better world is equity across all languages and knowledge systems, acknowledging that every different way of perceiving the world, the difference of languages, the law of the land, the understanding of country, all of that is incredibly valuable. And it's been something that we've lacked in Australian conservation since colonisation. We've had this complete eradication of this knowledge system and turning away from it. And places like Bush Heritage and ranger groups and mob have been, you know, caring for country in the right way. And I think it's a really exciting thing about where we're at in terms of conservation today is we have these conversations, like this great series that you're running in these radio interviews about understanding the difference in knowledge systems and not just, wow, there's this amazing value in traditional ecological knowledge, let's use it. It's like there's this incredible knowledge system. How can we interact with this knowledge in the right way, in a way that gives back to the knowledge holders, in a way that's non-extractive, in a way that benefits all people, in a way where there's not some random non-Indigenous person making thousands and thousands of dollars off of a knowledge system that's not their own and extracting and profiting from it. So. Mm-hmm.
And that was a little snippet of an interview between Tiani Adamson, the National Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Engagement Manager for Bush Heritage Australia, and Shay on 3CR's Climate Action Show. And in that interview, Tiani was talking about green colonialism and the importance of considering solutions to confront climate change and better ourselves as activists that really genuinely center First Nations knowledges, but also power in decision-making and action on climate injustice. You're tuned into Thursday Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM, and it is just coming up on 8:26 in the morning. And before we wrap up the show for today, we wanted to let you know about a snap rally that's happening this Friday, so tomorrow, to stop the demolition of the public housing flats. And organizers are calling a Honks for Housing mass rally this Friday morning at 7:30 a.m. at 12 Holland Court in Flemington. Now, 12 Holland Court is one of the first towers that was announced by the Victorian state government in September 2023 for demolition under its plan to demolish and redevelop all of the 44 high-rise public housing towers across Melbourne by 2051. There are still residents that are living in 12 Holland Court, but we understand now that there is the beginning of asbestos removal works in the public housing towers while residents are still living there. So again, head down to the snap rally on Friday, that is tomorrow, from 7:30 a.m. at 12 Holland Court in Flemington. And this is an initiative that's supported by groups including the Safe Public Housing Collective, Honks for Housing, and the Renters and Housing Union. Now, we will take you through what we covered in today's show. So first up, we were joined by Gurnung Jasper Cohen-Hunter, who spoke with us about past and present colonial assaults on the Birrarung or the Yarra River and talked about the upcoming exhibition Occupation Studies, Nyanhura Bayaral Birrarung, or They Tried to Tame Birrarung, which is a collaboration with artist Talia Palmer and which is showing at the Koori Heritage Trust at Fed Square from Saturday the 21st of March until the 13th of September.
And then we heard part of an interview with 3CR's Dissociative Identity Disorders Awareness Day program with Amy Ciara and guest Jack.
And then we heard from Jay Coonan, Research and Policy Anti-Poverty Centre, who joined us to discuss their latest article, Welfare, Not War. And after that, we heard from Dale Ruska, Director of Minjeriba Mogumpan Elders in Council, who was speaking about a petition calling for a truth-telling and healing commission on a national level. And so remember to sign that by finding the details in our show notes.
And lastly, we had an excerpt from 3CR's Climate Action Show, Shay interviewing Tiani Emerson, who is the National Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Engagement Manager for Bush Heritage Australia. And you can catch the links to all of our show notes.
Yes, and that is at 3cr.org.au/Thursday-breakfast, where you can also listen back to the podcasts of all of our previous shows. And we tend to get our podcasts up within the same day of you listening, so don't worry if you tuned in late. You'll be able to listen back or just head to our page, 3cr.org.au/Thursday-breakfast, to listen back to the audio on demand. If you want to hear all of our little stuff-ups that we edit out for our beautiful, shiny podcast, if you want to hear the real deal, just listen to our little Omni player. Now, we will catch you next week on Thursday Breakfast, but for now, take care. Bye.
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 3CR would like to thank our sponsors, Earth Greetings, cards that connect, care, and celebrate. Support wildlife and habitat with every purchase. Inspired by nature, giving back to the planet. Learn more at earthgreetings.com.au.
3CR Breakfast would like to thank the New International Bookshop, Melbourne's radical bookstore and venue, for their financial support of this program. You can find Nibs opposite reception in the Lygon Street wing of Trades Hall Carlton. You can buy books online and keep up to date with upcoming events at nibs.org.au.